You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
We are at the International Desk.
Yes. And today, like we said in the introduction, we are going to discuss the commemoration of the 10th anniversary, I suppose, of the slaughter of Tamils in Sri Lanka. So for those of you who might not know much about this, the Tamils are an ethnic group of Sri Lanka, which is a country and an island located southeast of India. The Tamils are a minority group in Sri Lanka, and they're mainly concentrated in the northern and eastern parts of the country. But currently, one third of the global Tamil population actually lives outside of Sri Lanka. A lot of them are in Canada and New Zealand, in Australia. So yeah, they have actually had to flee their country. And that is because they've been historically discriminated against in their home country. So here's a little historical background, maybe not so little, so that we can understand what happened in 2009. So Sri Lanka was under British colonial rule up until 1948 when it gained independence. And very soon after, ethnic tensions started arising between the majority ethnic group, which is the Sinhalese community, and the minority Tamil community. So there were multiple discriminatory policies that were put in place against the Tamils, such as making Sinhala the only official language, which was a language that wasn't really spoken at all by the Tamil population. And a couple of years later, in 1958, riots started breaking, and those were ethnic riots, or also called pogroms, because they were specifically targeting the Tamils, and they led to the death of around 1,000 of them, whilst a lot of other Tamils fled. And it really increased the distrust between the communities. The years that followed saw a lot of government action that were discriminatory as well. For example, there was the resettlement of Sinhalese people who were traditionally from the south of the country in traditional Tamil areas in the north. And there was also policies that were taken making it much harder for Tamils to have access to university. And so all of these events started creating a lot of resentment for the Tamil population in Sri Lanka. And in the 70s, the Tamil political party started asking for a separate state. Yes.
Yeah. I was just going to say it's interesting because you say that the Sinhala Only Act kind of creates a pretense for the following discrimination against Tamil people. And it's interesting because it was amended a couple of years after to be the Sinhala Only and Tamil Also Act. However, that kind of suggests the primary place of Sinhala and the Sinhalese people. But it wasn't until 1987 that this act was fully kind of transitioned out of the constitution, which shows kind of the passage of this, and which is an interesting thing, just an interesting interjection. Carry on.
Interesting fact, indeed. So during the 70s, like I was saying, there starting being calls for an independent Tamil state, and in the 70s as well saw the emergence of militant action groups, primarily youth groups, who I think became more and more, I guess the built up resentment made them more and more extreme, I suppose, in their quest for an independent state and through the means that they would use to achieve that goal. So there was a multitude back in the 70s, and then they all sort of like merged into the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, also called LTTE, or the Tamil Tigers, so that one became really the major youth militant group, and then just militant group who fought for independence. I kind of have to rush through that, I guess, briefly, but throughout the late 70s to the early 80s, There are more and more acts of violence and riots, ethnic riots, perpetrated against the Tamil people by Sinhalese mobs. And in July 1983, those mobs killed between 400 and 3,000 Tamils and caused 150,000 people to become homeless. And those events that occurred within a month have been called Black July. And that is what is credited to have started the civil war in Sri Lanka, which went on to last until 2009. And so that was a civil war between the government and the Sinhalese majority on one side and the Tamil Tigers and the Tamil minority on the other side. Both sides have been accused of human rights breaches. I think it's important to note as well that the rebel groups, the rebel Tamil Tiger group, also created its fair share of exactions.
I guess it's the nature of being a militant action group. The assassination of a prominent mayor in the mid-70s by the youth group, and then continued acts throughout the 90s, I guess. I guess that also feeds into the kind of painting of the picture of it kind of being a war rather than a kind of a less of a kind of attack on the Tamil people, which is an interesting thing of how it's perceived now. It's not a justification for the actions of violence committed by the Tamil people, but it's an interesting thing that often when you see that these people, say the Tamil Tigers bombed the sacred temples in the 90s, and when you hear that they assassinated a mayor, that's, it's very easy to take that as an act of violence outside of a context, but when you present it with the context of the kind of systematic oppression which you were describing prior, it kind of then adds a different element to it.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that it's not so black and white. And it has to be taken into a wider context, obviously. A lot of the Tamil Tigers were using children from, 14-year-old children to commit exactions. They had, they used suicide bombers. And obviously, those things are bad, and we can say that they're bad.
Yeah.
Put in a wider context where your opposition is doing similar things.
Yeah.
Kind of redistributes the cards, I suppose. I'm going to need to figure out where I was.
Sorry, that was an important digestion.
No, well, so what happened is that you had from 1987 to 2009, it was kind of back and forth decades of conflict between those two sides. There was a ceasefire and some peace talks that kind of led to a de-escalation of tensions, but basically, 2008, the Sri Lankan president sort of decides that this is it and starts launching a big offensive on the Tamil Tigers, which would lead to pushing the rebels further and further, closer and closer to the coast. And what happened is that there were zones called no-fire zones that were created where civilians would go. And like the name suggests, fighting in that area wasn't allowed. But they were sort of caught between both sides. And by pushing the rebels further and further away, the government forces sort of pushed the civilians further and further away as well, but also more and more into the fighting zones. With very little possibilities to get out. And again, I think it's important to note that it wasn't so black and white, the evil government soldiers doing evil things to the civilians and the Tamil Tigers defending the civilians, because there are reports of Tamil Tigers shooting civilians who are trying to flee and join the government zones. In order to try and save their lives. So that's also not so black and white. But in May, the situation escalates even more, And what happens next is actually fairly not so clear-cut and well-known. The events of May 2009. The government says that they were applying a zero civilian casualty policy, but photographs and video footage has emerged throughout the years that shows that there were shells being dropped on civilians in those no-fire zones. UN reports show that 40,000 people at least have been, civilians have been killed.
That was in that month.
Those final days. And then the UN did another report which suggests that it could actually be 70,000 people. And through the footage that we found, we could discover that not only had the government been basically shooting civilians or dropping bombs on civilians, but also the civilians that had been wounded wouldn't have access to medicine, anesthetics and antibiotics to be helped, because the government was putting some sort of an embargo on humanitarian aid passing through.
In that period as well, 12,000 named individuals, not to mention unnamed individuals, were disappeared or underwent disappearance, and this was all post the zero.
Yeah.
But just another thing to take into consideration.
Yeah, and there was also displaced people put into internment camps.
Yeah, 294,000 displaced.
Exactly.
Thereabouts, according to the UN.
And also, in the final days, what a lot of the footage that has been uncovered shows as well is that in the very final days when the victory was completely acquired to the government forces, the soldiers started basically mass murdering anyone, shooting blindfolded people, raping and pillaging civilians. That's really the horror that those footage show. And they've all been gathered by the journalist Callum McRae, who works for Channel 4, which is a UK TV channel. And he started receiving footage sent to him and gathering them, and he put them all in a feature-length documentary, which is called No Fire Zone, The Killing Fields of Sri Lanka, and it was released in 2013. And kind of try and piece together what happened and kind of like the chronology and the sort of exact horror of what happened then. And ever since, situation... Basically, there hasn't been that much of an effort for reconciliation and for accountability from the government for all these exactions. In 2015, the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations started a process that's called Accountability, which aims to investigate possible war crimes. And the government of Sri Lanka committed to both accountability and reconciliation mechanisms in place through justice. There was a question of having this sort of like mixed justice thing going on with foreign judges, international judges, and local forces kind of working together. But it has yet, the government has yet to really try to commit to what they said they would do. They've put in place an office for missing person, which doesn't seem to be very efficient. That's about the only thing that they've done.
There have been as few tiny other token gestures as well, it's not token, but the reintroduction of the Tamil version of the national anthem occurred in 2016. But considering what the reparations are reparations for, perhaps more, as you're suggesting, could and should be done.
I think the main thing is through justice, because what seems to have happened is that all of the people that did commit these crimes never got in trouble for it at all. And even worse, basically, some are just called war heroes, and it's been said, some political leaders have actually said that these so-called war heroes will be protected from prosecution. So there's a strong desire not to go ahead with prosecution and for, I guess, establishing the truth. So that would not help the process of reconciliation. And I had a conversation with the coordinator of the Federation of Tamil Associations of New Zealand. His name is Dr. Siva Vasantan, and he believes that the Sri Lankan government is just simply not willing to conduct this independent review. He believes that they're just trying to buy more time. They've been asking for a 2-year extension, so he doesn't really think that this is going to go anywhere. That road to reconciliation still feels pretty much like a long way away. And the government said a few things after, said that it was promising to give the Tamils back the land that was taken from them, and that hasn't really happened. There was hope in 2015 with the election of a more liberal president who was elected thanks to the support of the Tamil community. So hope for change, for transitional justice, but the accent has been put mainly on constitutional reforms rather than on that transitional justice. And so and also these economic reforms have yet to really deliver anything subsequent in the Tamil regions. Like, it's still this, you know, the north and east is still very much poorer than the south, and there were very little has been done basically on an economic front. Also, and that's much more worrying, in October, the former president, Mahinda Rajapaksa, who was the president back in 2009, he was named prime minister, and this really has created a renewed feeling of fear for the people that have that are still in Sri Lanka, notably former activists and journalists who have been specifically targeted. Al Jazeera has actually been reporting quite a bit on acts of torture that have been carried out. And when I talked to Dr. Vasantan about the climate back home and the current fate of the Tamils in Sri Lanka, he says that he really talks about a climate of fear for the population. He says that since the church bombing last Easter, the government has been using, so the government implemented a state of emergency, and he believes that that has been used to prevent Tamils from commemorating what they call Genocide Day and just speaking up. And so he says that academics and students and journalists are being arrested, being questioned. And he says that even the diaspora, the Tamil diaspora outside of Sri Lanka, is afraid to speak from fear of repercussion back in the home country. So there will be a vigil on the 18th of May that's organised in Aotea Square by the Federation of Tamil Associations of New Zealand. They will show photos and video footage of that documentary that I mentioned before. They're doing that to try and bring awareness amongst New Zealanders and New Zealand politicians about what happened and what can be done. There's also an online petition that will be presented to Parliament, and it asks for specifically New Zealand government to really take a more active part in making all the light of what happened 10 years ago.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/becasts.